Hello, this is Todd Butterfield for ID the Future. Today, we welcome Brendan Dixon, Principal Software Engineer at Microsoft, an accomplished leader, architect, and engineer with a passion for turning ideas into successfully delivered products and building teams. He brings a knack for designing elegant, resilient, and scalable architectures, a sought-after ability to bridge the gap between business and technology, and leadership skills trained in both small and large organizations. Wow! Welcome, Brendan.
That's what happens when I write my own marketing material, right, Todd?
Absolutely. It's the best source. Yourself, who knows you better than you?
I thought, thanks.
We'll be referring to three articles you wrote over the course of several months this year for evolutionnews.org around the subject of artificial intelligence. I'll admit it's something I don't look at too often. I don't hear about much, but it's fascinating to me ever since I started watching Star Trek, the original episodes in the 60s. First article, titled, "No, Your Brain Isn't a 3-Pound Meat Computer." So that's an interesting title. And the way you state it, apparently, it sounds like people are trying to simplify the brain into just meat that computes, like Michio Kaku or Elon Musk. Is that right?
Yeah, this is actually, the metaphor is actually very old in the AI community. And I don't even recall who first coined it. It may go back, and I could be wrong on this, but it might go as far back as like Marvin Minsky, who was one of the early leaders in AI at MIT. But this has been kind of a prevailing view for a very, very long time in the artificial intelligence community, that functionally the brain is nothing more than a computer. It just happens to be manufactured, as it were, out of biological neurons, liquid chemicals and whatnot, instead of the hardware we use to build the computers that we use for other purposes.
Right. You start with the premise in your article that some people think that we have much more to fear about artificial intelligence from the computers of the future than we've yet to see. But isn't your perspective that they're probably putting far too much weight on what computers really are, or far too little weight on what the brain actually is?
Yeah, I actually think it's both of those. You know, there's a real telling kind of anecdote here. Alan Turing, and one of my more recent articles, I mentioned this, Alan Turing, who in a lot of ways founded or co-founded a lot of what we think of as computer architecture and how modern computers work. So we're going way back to the beginning of at least modern computing.
Okay.
He, at that time, was already thinking about artificial intelligence, though not with that term. The reason that's telling is it says that there's been this predominant view in kind of the computer science engineering communities from the beginning, that they could build these amazing machines that would outdo the brain. And personally, as I've kind of watched this over the years, to me, it's just been this recurring step of both blind faith in what they can do,
right,
and really a massive devaluing of what our brain is and what it does. Yeah, so it's a bit of both, and it's been there for a very long time.
I'm just going to lead into a quote you mentioned by Roger Epstein, where he says, "No one really has the slightest idea how the brain changes after we have learned to sing a song or recite a poem." And that's just one small thing that the brain does throughout the course of any of our days. So it's a pretty great statement to consider. And so I'm wondering, who is this Epstein? And when he says something like this, that sort of exposes everything, is he upsetting the apple cart for those who have reduced our brains to mere computers or are trying to?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's why he wrote his article over on Aon. It came out, I forget when, you know, last May or something. I don't know Dr. Epstein. He's labeled as a senior research psychologist, you know, for the American Institute of Behavioral Research in California. He's written a ton of books. And, you know, he was a former editor-in-chief Psychology Today. So the guy is certainly no lightweight. And what he's responding to is largely in his article that the metaphor of saying that our brain is a computer is just a grossly bald metaphor. I mean, like all metaphors, it works for a few things. But as I said in my article, when you flip the metaphor around, begin to use it in a proscriptive manner. That is, it tells us things that we didn't know. You're going to get off lost very quickly. So what's interesting is I also, not in that article, but another one, I quote John Medina, who teaches over at the University of Washington. And again, he's a neurobiologist and understands these things quite deeply. And I love what he said. He said the brain is spooky. And the problem is, I think our tools for doing brain research are still, compared to a lot of things, pretty crude. You know, when we enter somebody's head and begin to do a lot of work on the brain, we tend to kill the patient. And so we're left with a lot of second-order tools. You know, fMRI is really a second-order tool. It's tracking just blood flow in the brain with the presumption that if oxygen is rushing to a part of the brain, it must be busy. You know, and that's fine, but it's very coarse. It doesn't really tell you much about what's going on.
True.
I just think we don't really know. I'm not faulting people for not trying to know. I just think that we don't. You know, we're learning. Right. We're grasping at these things.
Well, and the fact that there is so little that we know, as much as people are trying all over the world and have for decades, it still seems like, and maybe this is the gist of somewhat you were implying in your first article, that there are folks who are going to continue to try. Are we at risk of people of influence in science, academia, or inventors out there when they are trying to put too much trust in the future of machines and computers? Is that something to fear?
I think there is. I've got a good friend of mine who actually works for Paul Allen's Artificial Intelligence Research Lab, and he and I sit down and chat about these topics all the time. And one of the ones that's come up between himself and me is that, yeah, there is a risk. What concerns me is that by believing in some kind of emergence of a Terminator or some awe-inspiring intelligence that's going to wipe out humanity, my fear is that we're looking at the wrong problem. And if you look at the wrong problem, you're going to fix the wrong thing. If you fix the wrong thing, the real problem remains. That was really the point I wanted to get across in that first piece. And it's kind of a recurring theme. It's something that does concern me quite a bit. Kind of an interesting example of this recently, and it's sad, but there's a gentleman who died in Florida recently due to the malfunction of the Tesla self-driving feature.
Oh, yeah.
I don't understand exactly how Tesla implemented their self-driving feature. In likelihood, it was probably a mixture of what we call traditional if-then-else kind of logic, and probably a bit of pattern-matching logic, which is at the root of a lot of the newer AI. The reason it failed is the system was unable to distinguish between a white truck and a bright sunlight background behind it.
Oh, man.
Yeah, I mean, it's sad. Poor guy lost his life. But that's the kind of thing that worries me. It's not that we're going to see some Terminator. It's that, look, these systems are going to malfunction.
Right.
And if we blindly put our trust in them because we believe we're building something that's more awe-inspiring than our brain, we're going to have some serious problems.
Yeah, and the question that goes begging in all of this is, why bother when we have humans around us and they do a pretty great job? I guess people always want to try the new thing.
Well, no, I am not anti-AI. I've done my own work in AI. It's been a few years. I mean, I think there's value in it. I am not against it. What I am against is blind, almost religious, fundamental kind of faith in that we're building these things that are going to be awe-inspiring.
Gotcha.
I mean, a great example of this is, you know, and I'm not sure how Visa, you know, does their fraud analysis, but it's got to be approaching some of these kinds of techniques. You know, there's no way that either you or I, just looking at the data flowing across the internet or into a Visa system, could detect fraud. There's just too much. You or I would be overwhelmed. That's the kind of thing that these, you know, AI systems would just excel at, okay?
Yeah.
So I think that there's areas where we should be using these things. I think of instances, you know, somebody has a limited physical ability and we can try to augment it with a vision system or something. I think that's all great work. But I just don't want us to fool ourselves.
Right.
And I want us, because we're not fooling ourselves, we put the proper safeguards in place.
Yeah, that makes sense. That does make sense. And I appreciate it. It's useful to hear you put it in perspective like that, making this goes here and this goes there. Let's just keep it like that. So let's go to your second article, Watson's Goof.
Yeah.
I find this a playful article and kind of fun. What should we really fear from AI? And this is a reference to something that happened, but was talked about in a New York Times article about a computer named Watson, did well on a Jeopardy show. And in the article, not yours, but the New York Times, some fearfully asked Watson's developer if we'd end up with a HAL like in 2001, A Space Odyssey. And then others were excited and longed for a computer that has all the factual answers like on the Star Trek Enterprise. So what really happened with Watson on that show? And was it HAL or was it a computer on Star Trek or neither or either?
It was honestly neither, but I don't want to denigrate what they accomplished. Dr. Eric Larson, who has also contributed occasionally to Evolution News and is interested in the whole ID area as well, I just completed a very lengthy and wonderfully well done overview of how Watson actually works. And I would encourage anybody, you know, if they're interested in Watson and want to understand it more, to go read his really great piece.
Okay.
It's over at thebestschools.org is where it's at. It's called Jeopardy as Modern Turing Test. It's a wonderful essay. It's great. The reason I raise that is, you know, Watson, in one way, moved forward dramatically the fields of, you know, some natural language processing, definitely the field of question-answer systems for artificial intelligence. It really was an amazing accomplishment. But, and this comes out when you read both my piece and when you look at the review that Dr. Larson did, you know, Watson was built by IBM to do precisely one thing, and that was win at Jeopardy. And that's what it was trained to do. I mean, they spent hours and hours and hours tweaking it, bending it, twisting it, training it to make it work at Jeopardy. And it did that well. Now, they're hoping that the underlying architecture that they have can be retrained to answer questions, say, in another interesting domain, such as, you know, medicine, maybe helping doctors and nurses. But that's far, 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 far away from any kind of generalized question-answer system, you know, that either the computer on Star Trek would represent or, you know, HAL in 2001. We are so far away from those systems that at multiple levels. So I don't want to diminish what they did, but
right,
it's a baby step in that direction, regardless how amazing their accomplishments were.
True. I mean, it is amazing if you could picture a computer sitting between two other contestants on a live show and being able to participate the way it did. It's kind of mind-boggling. But it was, like you say, trained to do that one specific thing. And now, as you describe this, I think of, let's say, a kiosk at downtown at a place that makes ice cream. Discuss with it what you want on your ice cream, and then it'll make it for you or something like that. It seems like you could program one thing to do that one activity, whatever it is, or give you directions to somewhere in town or whatever.
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, I think we can have those kinds of machines now. People are deploying architectures, not exactly like Watson, but they lean that direction to provide support answers to questions. You can call in, you know, if something's not working, you pose your question, and, you know, they can come back, the machine can come back and guide you through, you know, what might be wrong. That's a very limited domain. And the minute you have a limited domain, and I'm dancing off in the technical terms, but what we mean by limited domain is you have a scoped, well-defined topic. And so if I'm in a paint store and I say something along the lines of, you know, what goes well with red, you're going to presume I'm meaning the red color, not something other in meaning of the word red. You know, so the minute we can constrain the domain, the minute we can get ourselves into a tightly defined topic, we can do well. In fact, that was actually IBM's massive accomplishment with Watson, is they were able to succeed without having to unduly restrict the domain. And that was really the big win. A lot of the work that had gone into Watson was work that had been done previously. Granted, they improved it. They
sure
did a better job with it. But the real magic was that they were able to get successful answers out of a machine without having a tightly restricted domain. And that's why people got so excited about Watson. But it's still a very long ways from general answer. In fact, there's a wonderful anecdote that Dr. Larson brings up in his article that I knew about, I didn't reference in mine, is that one of the tricks that IBM encoded into Watson is that they realized after doing some research that 95% of the questions posed in Jeopardy historically could be answered by the title of a Wikipedia article.
Oh, my word.
Yeah, it was one of those stunning accidental insights that they gained, and they burned that ability in the Watson. Now, that's not going to apply in medicine. That's not going to apply in a lot of things. So in one sense, brilliant engineering, another sense, they did have some luck on their side. So,
well, it is a lot of fun, and it does open the imagination. And yet, I think the gist of your article is that, as Dr. John Medina said, the brain is a little spooky. The brain, we don't know. Computers and programming, we do know. And maybe let's just wrap this content up with that, being aware that brains are not computers, computers are not brains, safe place to stay. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I do it. And I think that's really the point I'm trying to get across.
Well, Brendan, I want to devote a lot more time to your final article. Can you stick around for an additional episode?
Yeah, I can do that.
Okay, great. Thanks. I've enjoyed our discussion so far and your insights, and you've piqued my interest to read all those other articles, definitely. Next time, Artificial Intelligence and Its Limits is your next article. And until then, I'm Todd Butterfield for ID the Future.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2016. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org or idthefuture.com.